So with Forza dropping and this whole resurgence of like Japanese car culture kind of popping up on social media because of the game, I'm thinking back to like when we're more into the magazine side of the industry, and I like hearing some of those stories where you had these very unique builds for the time. And so the first time I ever saw like, you know, major engine swaps or anything that was out of the ordinary, it wasn't at my local scene. It was in these, you know, it was in these publications. And the one thing that I am starting to struggle with is, have we gotten to a point where these cars are so bolt-on ready that we're going to start to see less and less of that cool customization that we saw back in those days? Because I miss that. Like, I miss the, you know, flipping into the magazine and the first time you got to see a S14 with a LS swap, for instance, because it wasn't done. It wasn't popular. There weren't kits out there yet. And I feel like now we're not getting that as much. Like, I maybe that's part of why I feel like the car magazine culture might have died also, is that cars started to become very bolt-on ready. And I was kind of thinking, you know, if anyone knew what that time was like, you know, from the inside, it would have been you. And I know you were dealing with a lot of freelancers and stuff at that time. So,
yeah, I think one of the main reasons that, you know, magazines as a whole sort of fell off the map has to do with just the internet in general, right? Because with the magazine world, there's always a long waiting period, because if the Formula D happens, you know, this Saturday and a magazine is there covering it, it's not going to show up on the newsstands for like 2 months probably, right? By then, because of the internet, it's old news. Right now we get it immediately as it's happening. We're getting stories, we're getting reels, we're getting, you know, X posts, whatever it is. So that was a major factor. What you're saying though, I understand what you're saying, with seeing stuff first, like an LS swap, when those first started coming around, they might have been happening around the country once the word got out about it. But by the time it got covered by a magazine, it was already kind of, I wouldn't say old news, but it was already kind of being done. I think for a lot of people at the time, you know, the internet, the social media wasn't really a big thing at that time. It wasn't really around. So you were seeing stuff kind of break in print. And that was kind of like the norm. There was a weird transition period where it was like, okay, well, since the internet came in and it kind of took over and social media is speeding things up, let's use the digital front in order to get like breaking stuff out first, and then you know, kind of save bigger stories or maybe like certain types of builds for print. It doesn't really work though, because again, no one has the patience to wait for that anymore. And it's been that way for years. I'm kind of the same way. Like if I wanted to see event coverage, I'm not going to wait 2 months to see it. I'll just go, you know, poke around on a website or poke around on social and find it. You know what I mean? So it really didn't stand much of a chance with like the lightning fast social media strike. That was pretty much it. That pretty much killed it.
So,
but, yeah.
So, cause to me, from the outside looking in, I always felt like the uniqueness of cars from that time period were so different than what we're dealing with now. I feel like everything now on social media is very cookie cutter.
You know, I understand what you're saying, but I think a lot of that comes down to things kind of going cycles. And I think that for someone like you that was, you know, you've sort of been like this lifelong enthusiast, you worked at a shop for a number of years, you kind of seen it all, you know, inside and out. For you, things start to look the same because you're seeing pretty much the same thing on, like I said, you know, digitally, right? You're seeing the same sort of like wheel setup, seeing the same sort of engine swaps, the same seats, everyone's using the same steering wheels. But you have to remember, if it was, you know, 15 years ago, maybe like your earlier days, like, you know, you're 18, 19 years old, you weren't seeing that stuff every day, right? It was few and far between. Even car meets, there weren't a ton of those back then. Now they're like every weekend. I'm sure out there where you are too, they're every Saturday or Sunday, there's something going on, right?
Yep, 100%.
But back then there wasn't. There was like maybe a big car show quarterly, maybe, you know, once a year or something like that, or, you know, Nopi or something like that. And then, of course, you know, the magazine stuff. But even with that, you weren't seeing exactly the same stuff over and over again. Now it's like just constantly recycled. And everyone's got a page for their build, and they're constantly posting pictures of it and, you know, making TikToks and all that kind of stuff. It just sort of, it saturates it a bit. And I think it kind of kills the creativity a bit. But this is kind of like I said, it's a cycle.
The one thing that I have really liked, and I think that might be part of it too, is that the good that's come out of that whole social media, like pushing into that realm, is that I'm seeing a lot of builds from overseas and a lot of car shows and car scenes overseas. And I gotta tell you, Southeast Asia, holy crap.
Right.
The shows that they put down on they're putting on in Thailand and things like that. They're taking over, you know, those massive parking garages filled with hundreds, and all the cars are just absolutely stunning. And I know that there's some differences, like the cars cost more there to get in there, and there's like weird things
in
like that.
In some cases,
I know that there's like weird things like that, but these cars are, they're just absolutely stunning. Like, you know, you go to a car meet here, and I'm not trying to knock us too hard, but it's a lot of regular traffic. Like, there's a lot of, I have a car with a set of wheels and a hacked off exhaust, let's say. That tends to be a lot more common. And then I'm looking at these meets, and they're not, and this isn't like some, you know, closed off professional meet where they're curating the cars. This is just even a local meet. But every single thing there is stunning. Or we're looking at like Sunday morning at Daikoku. Every car, even the Honda Beats that are there, are absolutely the coolest little things running around. And yeah, of course you have a Ferrari F40 on the other side of the parking lot, and the Lamborghini guys are there and all that. But that happens on Long Island too. Like, Cars and Coffee here, you know, and you're in an area, I'm sure it's the same way, where they run the gamut. And I'm not saying that that's not what we're getting, but I feel like we're getting less and less of that quality here that I'm seeing out there.
Yeah, you know, when I was still in the media world, I was a little bit dumb, because I didn't realize how big it was in Thailand. Like, I didn't know. I knew there was obviously building going on out there, but I didn't know how in depth it was. It wasn't until I started seeing some builds come from there through, I don't know if you've ever heard of Street Metal. Street Metal's like a media guy out there. He's Thai, and he covers everything. Like, he's really, really in deep with like drift, drag, everything, right? The car shows, all that stuff. So he was kind of the guy, and I think I reached out to him, and we started kind of communicating, and he started getting me some coverage from out there, from, you know, certain vehicles I thought were really unique, especially in the Honda world. And then, excuse me, and then events as well. And then later on, you know, CB Media, Chad moved out there as well. He was a freelancer with me for a number of years. And then he moved out there, and he, you know, his YouTube blew up, which is incredible.
Actually, that's where I started to see a lot of the meets overseas, was actually from him. And that's kind of what got me exploring a little more. And being that, you know, Kony has such ties to Malaysia and all that, like, the Malaysian car scene is insane also. Mm-hmm. You know, it's getting really cool to see what's out there. Like, you know, even in the Middle East, like Dubai and things like that, you know, I'm a Nissan guy. So the Nissan Patrol has like this like little spot, that and the Safari are like two of my cool little nerdy truck things from like the SUVs, but they have some of the fastest, straight six powered patrols, and they are racing up sand dunes. Things that I would never think.
Yeah, those are cool. I like those.
Things
I
would never think of. You know, like it's really cool that now, with social media being in the forefront, we're getting to see those things that I never would have thought I'd seen. Like, you know, we've talked about in the past where, you know, you guys covered back in the magazine days, the Time Attack cars and things like that. And that was awesome, because that was new and fresh, and we had never seen anything like that, because Time Attack was just pioneering itself then. This is, every time I'm like getting on and seeing these things from all over the world, I'm seeing a whole new side of car culture and racing that I've never seen. And I kind of, that's what's really cool. You know, I'm not saying that the US doesn't have that. I'm saying there are places where I wish we were doing more. I'm really happy Formula D. I'm going this weekend, and they added a Manji in the center of the freaking course for the first time in a long time. And I think them adding that was such a good design choice, because I missed 2015 Formula D. I missed the cars being a little slower, having a little bit more technique behind them and them literally mirroring each other around some of these clipping points. I miss those days. I think that was peak, and to see that coming back is really cool. But we're still dealing with a lot of track closures, a lot of, you know, negative press because of people doing dumb things on the internet and posting it. And you know, obviously there's that whole problem with the street takeovers hurting, you know, the public's perception of all car people, because they automatically associate us.
I don't really put those into the car.
No, but they I'm saying the public associates car people with that culture, even though they're independent of each other. So let me just clarify that. Right. But that's the problem, is that perception, and that has hurt us. And that,
I wonder what that effect is. Like, if there is an issue, like we were talking about Thailand, for example, is there a lot of guys that are doing crazy stuff and the local authorities are like not having it? Or is it that the culture is so much different that it's just much more respectful? They do have a strong tie to drag racing there. You know, drift is starting to grow there as well. But it feels like when I was looking at stuff from there, video footage and stuff like that, even like, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, it felt like mid-90s U.S. to me.
100%.
Just because it was so fresh and so new, and like everyone's like building a car that can like show and drag, and they put it on the street.
And I love that. And I think that's what I kind of was alluding to with this whole thing, is that I miss that feeling. Like, I miss that it's, I have one car that I need to do this. Like, I need to get out there. It needs to look good. Yeah. It needs to tear down the track and do great. And then the drag strips kind of feel like that same time period. Like, they're smaller venues. They're more intimate. And don't get me wrong, when Cletus set all his stuff up down in Florida, it has that same feel. Yeah. And I think that's why it's done so well, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think it captures that. And I grew up going to MIR, so it, but before they put in the big press box and all that, I was going there then when they still had wood bleachers. Like, you get splinters on a Friday night at Test and Tune. So I miss that time period. And I think it's just nostalgia at this point, obviously.
But
it's really cool to see that that's happening overseas. And then something that I'm jealous of is that they're getting to do all of that with the technology that we have now. And I'm like, man, we used to have to work so much harder just to have the same amount of fun. These guys are like, oh, I just grabbed a Haltech and plugged it in. I was like, man, that would have been nice. We had a socket PC board.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. In terms of like Southeast Asia, I hear what you're saying, but I wonder if you're seeing it now because of social media, right? Take that away, though. They've probably been building cars and doing the same sort of like hot rodding as long as, maybe longer than the US, right? Because they've had access to better versions like SRs and stuff like that. So,
yeah, true.
I would think that it's probably been this way for many, many years. It's not like they're just getting into it now, or, you know, in the last couple of years.
Oh, no.
It's
just saying.
We're seeing it, though. We're seeing it now because, you know, obviously we have more visual access to it all, which is great. One of the other things that I noticed when I was working with Street Metal is, like, every car had so much titanium on it. I was like, why? Every car has like titanium shock tower bars and suspension pieces and dress up. Everything is titanium. And then I did a little research, and it's like that area, because the labor is so cheap and manufacturing costs are so cheap, everyone does titanium. So even like the, what did you call those little taxi things? Little three-wheeler taxis?
Oh,
what are they called?
Tuk-tuk.
Yeah, like those vehicles, like they've got titanium shock tower braces and like, you know, like everything's titanium. And I was like, man, there's so much stuff there. And, you know, that was really, really big here for a while. It still is, but I mean, it's everywhere. And that's why it's so much cheaper. The labor is so much less. So you can get a lot of custom fabric, and they have some really talented fabricators out there that can make whatever you want, you know? So there's some really, really cool stuff to see. And that was always what kind of drew me in the most, is like seeing the custom fabrication and the stuff they were doing. A lot of the stuff they were doing was like, you know, shaved engine bays and like really clean swaps and, you know, ITBs, turbos, that stuff, just like here. But I really liked the custom one-off pieces that, you know, I hadn't seen anywhere else. That was kind of a cool touch.
So if we can move up a little bit, because I know we were kind of focusing on Southeast Asia, and I did bring up Daikoku in Japan, and that's kind of where I kind of got going with this. Now, I came up when the Japanese JDM car culture, the JDM side of it, was really like something we were watching. You know, I was watching at, you know, 12, 13 years old as I was getting older. You know, I watched Smoking Nagata, and I watched, you know, the builds over at Mines, which we've talked about in the past, that, you know, Built by Legends is still doing the mines stuff, yeah, with the R34s. Like, those names and getting to drive those cars in Gran Turismo and stuff like that. How did that compare and contrast to the way that the U.S. car culture was? Because I feel like there you had a lot more of, we're going to take what we have and make it the best we can. And kind of to the same effect of that same time period was when I would say that I saw the guys ripping out their, you know, KAs or SRs and dropping in an LS instead. Was there some difference between like the Japanese tuning culture and the American tuning culture in that regard?
Yeah, there's always been differences, right? We've always looked up to the Japanese because that's where the vehicles come from originally, right? And they were doing the coolest stuff. And this, you know, obviously I'm older than you, so like what I was seeing wasn't really the video stuff as much as it was seeing stuff in print, you know, old Option magazines and stuff like that. So we were seeing what they were doing.
I had a lot of times, Option DVDs, thank you.
Yeah, right. I had Option VHS, so that's all, you know, it goes way back. But like with those books, you know, we would go to like the local, at least here in SoCal, like they have like a Japanese market. You go there and you pick up a few of those, and they were super expensive. And then you kind of flip through and see like, oh, I wonder if I can find these ITBs, or I wonder if I can find this wing or whatever it is. And you go through your sources and try to find someone that can get it for you, right? Like that was what was done. And the guys that could get like one or two pieces were like the ones that stood out the most at, you know, like the street races and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, we're talking like, you know, early 90s, mid 90s. One thing that's interesting though is like over the years, some of that has shifted a bit because there is a huge number of people in Japan that are building cars to more USDM style. And I don't think this is a big surprise. Like people know this already, especially with, you know, with Instagram and stuff. But prior to the social media buzz, like there was always a big push to build USDM style stuff. And, you know, a buddy of mine who lives there, he throws an event every year called K-Day. And that event is like primarily based on vehicles that have a ton of US influence. And I'm talking like, you know, an Integra with like a US front end conversion, or like a Civic Type R converted to look like a DX. You know what I mean? Like, which sounds like you're going backward to us, right? But then over there, like that's the cool thing, right? And if you have a left-hand drive car, you're the guy, right? Okay. So that was a big deal. So I think there's a little bit of a mix up there in terms of people that are newer to kind of our car culture, and they're always thinking that everything has to be JDM, but a lot of times there's a subculture that's kind of the opposite. It's that grass is always greener type thing, right? So you want what you can't have. So at least in the Honda world and Nissan world, you know, I don't know if it goes well beyond that, but that's what I've experienced. You know, and it's like now it's such a mishmash of everything from everywhere. And so I think if you're building a car right now and you want something unique, you should probably be pulling inspiration from everywhere, from Japan, from the US, from Thailand, from Australia, from, you know, from everywhere. Yeah. So, I mean, that's another one too. Like Australia is such a unique section. There's so many high powered, like wild, wild builds in that region. It's insane.
You're speaking my language.
So I really like the stuff they do there.
Yeah. Coming from the RB world, like I had a infatuation with RBs for such a long time that coming from the RB side of it, I have a love for the Australian, you know, car culture that comes along with the, you know, the Cootamundra drags and those guys running that all down there. So you're speaking my language. And, actually speaking of unique things to come from Australia, I'm loving that we're seeing more Barra swaps. Like being the Ford side of me loves this whole, like we're starting to see them trickle in more. And just recently I started following somebody on social media that has a 300ZX with a Barra swap. And I'm so pumped to see that thing come to fruition. I think Adam LZ built that Mustang with he did his GT350 after it blew up. He put the Barra engine in it. And I think that is probably one of my favorite cars of his. If I had to choose one of the cars from his collection, I'd probably take that. So the car scene down there is insane. You know, whether it be, I grew up watching Mighty Car Mods, you know, I would say probably most of my adult life, I've been watching those guys, and I love what they've put on, and some of the guys that they've worked with, like Turbo Yoda and I can't remember the other gentleman's name, but they're great, you know, and you get some really cool insight. And a lot of that 8HP stuff actually came from me seeing 8HPs being used in the Australian market.
Right.
And that's kind of what started that whole conversation with Greg from Turbolamic, was
right.
seeing the swaps that they were doing down in Australia. And I love it, man. That, if there was one place I'd want to go for a car culture trip, I know everyone's like, I'm going to Japan. I want to go to Australia. I really want to go to Australia for that trip.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there's enough information on Japan's car culture online. That you're not going to be too surprised now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm saying this right, but I remember, and this is like probably mid 90s, maybe early, there was a website called, I think it was called X-Vitamidi in Australia, and I'm probably butchering that, but it featured like a lot of their R32 street racing.
Okay.
I don't know if it was street racing or if it was like an organized event, but on the street. And I remember they were just super fast. And I remember me and my friends just watching that stuff all the time. This is like when, you know, we're all like getting computers and getting, you know, yeah. getting into the internet or whatever, the dark ages, right? But it was really, really cool to see that. And that's what really kind of turned me on to Australia originally. And then over the years, they've always just built like these super high horsepower, just wild, wild builds. Yeah. So there's always cool stuff there. Always.
Yeah.
Always. And it's like not just JDM cars, not just Japanese cars, but all the cars there. They always, well, you know, like the Holdens and stuff.
Yeah, I was about
like
to say, really, really cool stuff. The Ford, you know, between GM with the Holden side of it, and then obviously Ford Australia. You know, you have the Falcons and the Monaros and everybody, you know, and some of those cars obviously trickled over. I mean, you get the Pontiac G8, but we never got some of those cool, like, as I said, the Barra never made it here. And I hate that Ford never took that chance to bring, I think it would have done really well in our market. I don't know if you remember, do you remember the Turbo T-Birds back in the day? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Of course, yeah.
That was such a popular car that they could have done that, you know, a modern updated one instead of making that ugly thing that they made. I don't know if you remember the one from the 2000s that made it look
like...
Yes.
It was like a pancake. It was so flat.
Yeah.
It was such a weird look.
Instead of doing that, imagine if they would have done a turbo straight six freaking bring back of the T-Bird. I would have been all about that. I think that would have been my first car instead of the 442. But that's just me.
Yeah, the we mentioned the Holden. Holden's interesting because... You know, for people that aren't familiar, like, you know, obviously we have the U.S. version, or we had the U.S. version. And when I see those, like the GTOs, it's interesting because they really looked toward pulling parts or inspiration from the ones that were being built in Australia to, you know, to build the ones over here. And there's a huge, you know, a huge enthusiast market for that. I have a buddy that has a website called Maverick Man and Maverick Man Carbon. And he specializes in a lot of parts for those vehicles. Yep. And like a lot of the guys that have them, they went like the Holden interior, they went like the Holden badges, or, you know, whatever. Seemed just like a guy with a Civic trying to get all the, you know, the Type R parts or whatever. So it's a really, really big, super tight knit community. Yeah. And those guys are very, very dedicated. And obviously, you know, that the engine is like, you know, legendary. So there's a ton of aftermarket parts for it. So
correct me if I'm wrong. It's an LS2, it's a 6.0, right? Or something like that. It's the LS3. LS3, something
like
that.
It's an LS.
Yeah. So it's
all the same to me.
Yeah. Check out the engine anatomy on LSs that's going to come in the future.
Right.
They're all going to be
that's
the
right,
same.
That's
all it's going to be. LS engines. They're all the same to me. And that's going to be the whole video.
I can't wait to write that and not know the difference between them. But it's LS, and it's like, you know, they make huge power, obviously. You know, there's turbo ones and the supercharged ones, and there's all these different versions.
HSV, that supercharged Pontiac, it's essentially the Pontiac G8 with the supercharged LSA in it. That one I do know, and oh man, that's a cool car. Those are sick. Definitely spent some time on bringing back to the Forza thing, driving that thing around in Australia years ago on the old Forza games. So I've been there.
Yeah. Right. But,
Yeah, in my dreams I've been there. I've LARPed. Right. I've LARPed. Right. But
right.
But no, and that's what's really cool. You know, even over in like the UK, we have a couple of guys that are running our wheels over there. They're really, you know, you see a lot of really great track racing. I can't remember, maybe the track was like Hockenheim or something like that, I think is the name of the track out there. Some guys running out there and really seeing a great track culture even coming from that side of the pond, which is really cool. Like I think the even if locally sometimes it feels like the car culture is shrinking, it's really cool that we can look out and see that there's still segments that are excelling and ones that we didn't even know about that are doing really cool things in other parts of the world.
Well, yeah, now you can, but you know, you bring up a good point. Like the UK, for example, when I was young and getting into cars, you know, again, magazines were the access point, right, to figure out what was going on. And I remember there was a few magazines specifically catering to the UK that were at Tower Records. Like, okay. They had a big magazine section, right? You kind of flip through them, and all I would see on there was like these cars I'd never seen before, like just tiny little cars, right? Mm-hmm. And they were always dumped. They always had really like shiny chrome wheels and a bunch of like stuff on them, like so much stuff, just pieces of flair on them.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that there was such a big like performance community there, because all I saw was what I saw through the magazines, and it was always that stuff, along with some random nudity in those books, which was really weird. But anyways, it was very strange magazines. But like, what, you know, when I would look at those, I would see like the chrome wheels, and they were always dumped to the ground. They didn't have a lot of power, and that's what I thought that whole, you know, car movement was there. I had no idea that there was such a big race community. Yeah. until years later, you know, you kind of do your research and see. But in those early days, that's all I knew, because that's what the magazine showed me. You know what I mean? That was a very small, you know, peek into it, because, you know, obviously we're not getting a bunch of UK magazines out here, especially in those times. But, you know, with the internet, you can see it all now.
Yeah, now,
you
know, now
years later.
It's really cool that, you know, that, and I mean, as we've kind of made our way, I guess we should kind of get into South America a little bit, because we can't leave all those guys out. Because last year I went to Jamaica, and I got to tell you would not know going there that when you get there, the car culture is going to be so on point. But man, I saw modified, well, I guess they call it's an Evo. It was an Evo. I guess it's still an Evo or a Mirage or whatever they call it. Thing was, you know, Evo 10 equivalent, done up to the nines, you know, tons of customized motorcycles. A lot of them are like those little, the bikes that you would see in like Vietnam and stuff, those little two-stroke motorcycles, all kitted out. Like it was so cool to see, you know, all these different modified vehicles that, you know, you're going to go on vacation. You're not expecting to hear the guys drag racing at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, a couple miles away on the other side of the, you know, the hill mountains or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool that those things exist. I would have loved to like escape out and go find them. I don't know if I would have ever came back. I probably would have stayed in Jamaica and been like, you know, sorry guys, I'm going to stay here. I'm moving in. We got a drag strip over here, but yeah, exactly.
Max is going to Photoshop you with some dreadlocks real quick.
That's exactly. Think, so he just said it in the background. He just said, hi, old man, I'm Nick. But yeah, no.
Use Claude or something.
But, you know.
I remember I'd done a few pieces on events that were happening in Jamaica, you know, many years ago. And it was all drag centric. They were really, really big in the drag racing, at least for the Honda crowd. I haven't seen much, you know, recently, but I know that they had a thriving aftermarket. You know, it was big community there.
I was surprised with the cars. I saw old Corollas all done up, a ton of like, a lot of the, believe it or not, a lot of Honda stuff, but like they were all like four-door Hondas, but they were all modified, but they were all like, you know, really nice, like done nice. You know, I was actually
you kind of have surprised. They have to build like whatever's available, right? There's going to be different vehicles in different regions. I think when I had ordered a set of mirrors from a vendor in Thailand, and we were talking, and I wanted to order something for that was for my Civic. I wanted to order something for my older Integra, and it's, you know, it's a 92, and he's like, we don't have those here. Like I can't make anything for that car. I don't have anything to base it off of, because we never got that car here. And I was like, oh, I didn't think about that. So,
we run into the same problem with wheels. Believe it or not, I get a lot of guys that will message in from other parts of the world, and they're like, hey, I got this one vehicle. And I'm like, I don't even know what vehicle that is. So let's start. So I know the manufacturer, but what are we talking about here? And sometimes we get lucky and it'll be like a global platform where everything crosses over.
Of course.
But
like a Ford. Yeah.
But now that's more common. It used to not, you know, I get some of the older cars and they don't cross, you know, so it all depends. You know, and obviously, you know, in DR and in Puerto Rico, everyone knows the car culture there is top tier. You know, they do big drag racing stuff there. You know,
of course,
I was talking to Luis about rotaries coming from Puerto Rico the other day. And cause talking about what's going to be going down when they do the, imports versus domestics and, you know, USA versus the world down at MIR, you know, so we were sitting there BSing about that. And, you know, it's really cool to see an underutilized platform, because let's be honest, like in the US there are some really good rotary guys, but down in the islands, you know, in DR and in Puerto Rico, I feel like they really adopted that engine and did a lot of good stuff with it that translated back to the US market too, obviously. But
yeah, there's a lot of rotary builds in the US and there's some good ones too, but there, like, that's the capital of the world, like that's the bread and butter, right? They know that engine better than anybody does. Yeah. You can see them, you know, with the bucket, and they take it apart and they put everything in the bucket. And then they send the bucket and put it all back together. It's like nothing. It's like clockwork, right? So they can do anything with those engines, and that's like I said, it's their bread and butter.
Their engine's rebuilt. I'm still halfway through the oil change. Like, hold on, I'll be there.
Yeah, they're so good. It's crazy. And they're so fast.
It's absolutely nuts. And then, you know, it's cool. We're getting a lot more. We actually picked up a driver recently that races down in Mexico. He's down there, and we're starting to get a lot more guys in South America and working our way through. So it's really cool to see that we're getting such a global reach in the car community. And I feel like, you know, I was sheltered from that for a very long time. And I think that's been one of the biggest changes from going from like a print media world to a digital world now.
Yeah, I know everyone talks about, like, well, not everyone, a lot of people talk about magazines should come back and it was a better time and all that stuff. And listen, I get it. You know, I worked in that world for a lot of years, but I think you can't deny how much better access is now with, you know, all the internet stuff we have now. There's certainly a place for magazines, but I think now it's got to be like those special, like, once or twice a year, or maybe like a quarterly type thing. It can't be a monthly thing. There's just not a market for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, everyone can kind of agree on that. Or agree to disagree, I guess you'd say. But there is a spot for like coffee table style books, you know? And I know there's like Porsche ones. There's like there's a few BMW ones that are out there.
Can we name drop Larry Chen's photo book? Because oh my gosh, that thing is absolutely stunning.
And that's like a good example,
right?
It's
a little expensive, somebody that's, but
yeah, but if there's something special, like obviously Larry Chen is a special photographer, right? And like he has, you know, a special product. That's something that you don't want to just see like on Instagram. Like you want to experience it, you want to touch it.
Yeah, yeah. I get it.
I think not everyone. Some people would be like, man, I'm not paying for that. I get it free. You know, I understand. I get it. There's, you know, there's people that are very budget about stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think for a lot of the older people or people that are really, really dedicated to the car community, like that type of thing, being able to hold it and see it is a little bit different experience, you know, and owning it and having it, you know, at your home.
Having it forever. I still have all my D-Sports, my Super Streets, my Importuners. So on that note, speaking of D-Sports, Super Street, Importuner, which of your car magazines, I'm obviously talking in the comments now, which of your car magazines were your favorites? Which were the go-tos? Which ones did you not pick up? Leave them in the comments below. Let us know. Anything else, Matt?
That's it for me.
That's it for me too. Peace out.
All right.